there that, you know, confirm that.
All right, that's all the time we have for this show. Thanks to manager Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, Firas Al-Najm, joining us from Toronto, and international coordinator Samadoun, Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, Charlotte Cates, joining us from Vancouver. And a special thanks to you for staying with us on tonight's Spotlight.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Chapter Ali Imran from the Holy Quran, verses number 29 and 30, recited by Saeed Maliki.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. قل إن تخفوا ما في صدوركم أو تبدوه يعلمه الله ويعلم ما في السماوات وما في الأرض والله على كل شيء يوم تجد كل نفس ما عملت من خير محضرا وما ويحذركم الله والله رؤوف بالعباد صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Say, whether you hide what is in your heart or manifest it, Allah knows it, and He knows whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth, and Allah has power over all things. On the day that every soul shall find present what it has done of good and what it has done of evil, it shall wish that between it and that evil there were a long duration of time, and Allah makes you to be cautious of retribution from Himself, and Allah is compassionate to the servants.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Look at our top stories this hour. In China, Xi Jinping secures a historic third term as the country's leader for another 5 years at the end of the Communist Party Congress. Iran criticizes the U.S. for making contradictory comments regarding negotiations aimed at reviving the 2015 deal. Also, tensions remain high in the occupied West Bank, where Israeli forces killed two Palestinians in 24 hours. Hello and welcome. Your world news come to you live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. It's good to have you with us. Xi Jinping will be the leader of China for another 5 years after the Communist Congress Party confirms his status. President Xi was picked as the party's general secretary for a third term in a closed-door vote. That means he will be elected president at the annual meeting of National People's Congress in March. The new lineup of the party's seven-member standing committee, which Xi resides, was also announced. Speaking to media at the event, President Xi said China has opened its doors to the world for better interaction. He noted that the country is on the path to modernization and will move towards securing better prosperity for its people. During its week-long gathering, the Congress approved the addition of new wording to the party charter, elevating Xi's core status. Independent China specialist Andrew Leung says Xi Jinping is facing both domestic and global challenges during his third term in office.
Domestically, I think President Xi is known to have mentioned a number of traps for the nation. The first trap he mentioned was in the, 2018 Party Congress. He referred to the Tacitus trap, T-A-C-I-T-U-S, the name after the Roman emperor. Tacitus trap means if other countries do not believe in the Communist Party, for example, then whatever the Communist Party does would be seen negatively. The second trap is everybody is familiar with is the Thucydides trap, rivalry between the world's two great superpowers. And the third trap is the middle income trap, which entrapped a number of developing countries for a long, long time in middle income without rising to higher levels of development. The fourth trap is what Professor Joseph Dye of Harvard Kennedy School refers to the as the Kindleberger trap. That is, even if a country reaches the top of the world superpower, it's questionable whether that country can deliver in terms of global governance. As, for example, the ability of the United States at the moment to be able to maintain global stability is in doubt.
Iran has condemned contradictory comments by U.S. officials regarding negotiations aimed at reviving the 2015 agreement. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian says American authorities continue to exchange messages with Iran, while at the same time fanned the flames of anti-government riots in Iran. The top diplomat argues that the U.S. or U.S. officials are seeking to exert political pressure in an effort to win concessions during negotiations. The comments were an apparent response to statements by U.S. authorities who have announced that the JCPOA revival negotiations are no longer on Washington's agenda. Amir Abdullahian rejects this and says it is a priority for the Americans to reach an agreement, and they want that as soon as possible. The foreign minister stressed Iran will move within the framework of an agreement in which its red lines are respected. He added, however, that Iran will not leave the negotiating table. We have asked peace activist Daniel Kovalik about the United States' ultimate plan by pursuing a double standards policy toward Iran. Here's what he had to say.
Well, look, I would like to see the deal entered into again by the U.S., but I'll be honest, I don't predict that it will be. For the reason you say, the U.S. does not want deals with Iran. It wants regime change. And honestly, I think it's just going to continue to play games with Iran over the nuclear deal and other issues and do everything it can to overthrow the government. So where is the incentive for Iran to negotiate here under those circumstances? I don't see it.
President Ebrahim Raisi says Iran is determined to win the sanctions war imposed by the U.S. and other adversaries, citing a 13% growth in non-oil exports this Iranian fiscal year. Raisi says those who have enforced sanctions against Iran aim to prevent the country from achieving any growth or producing or exporting anything. He says the U.S. Treasury Department has created numerous obstacles for Iranian exporters around the globe, as enemies want Iran to be a mere consumer. But Raisi stressed that Iranian manufacturers and businessmen are determined to promote exports now that demand is rising for quality Iran-made products, including military hardware. He says this has angered Iran's enemies, who don't want the country to grow and capture markets. A Palestinian man has been killed in a bomb explosion in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. A Palestinian resistance group has identified him as Tamer al-Kilani, blaming Israel for the assassination of his fighter. It has warned of a harsh response to the regime. Hours earlier, a 32-year-old Palestinian man died in hospital after being shot by Israeli forces in the Galgilia neighborhood of occupied Al-Quds. Tensions have intensified in the occupied West Bank, with the Israeli military conducting near-daily raids on Palestinian towns and villages. On Saturday, Israeli soldiers shot and wounded a 16-year-old Palestinian in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of Al-Quds, claiming he'd been involved in a stabbing attack that left an Israeli man critically injured. Mona Kandil, our correspondent in Ramallah, is with us now for more details on that story. Mona, it's good to talk to you. So tell us more about the killing of two Palestinians by the Israeli regime.
It seems that at this time a Palestinian was assassinated by Israeli forces in the Nablus area. What happened is that according to the newly formed Palestinian group, Lion's Den, Tamer al-Kilani, a senior member of the Lion's Den group, had been assassinated in Nablus when an explosion, let's say, or an explosive device attached to a motorcycle detonated in Nablus Old City, and he was passing by this motorcycle, and he was killed. So the group are accusing the Israeli military and the Israeli forces for assassinating one fighter of the group, Tamer al-Kilani. As you have mentioned, a Palestinian had been killed by the Israeli forces in Qalqilya last night when, according to the Israeli military, this Palestinian man, Rabi al-Rabi, tried to enter the lands occupied in 1948. This is the Israeli story, near the separation wall, and they opened fire at his vehicle, killing him last night. A Palestinian teenager was also accused by the Israeli forces for stabbing an Israeli settler in Al-Quds. Then the Israeli police chased him and opened fire at him near a football playground where dozens of Palestinians were there. A number of Palestinian children were playing actually at the playground, but the Israeli forces opened fire at Mohammed Rajab from Shafat refugee camp, seriously wounded him, and then he was transferred to an Israeli hospital because he is under custody.
Mona, also a resistance group has identified the first victim that you just talked about, Tamer al-Kilani, as a resistance fighter, and it has pledged a harsh response. Can you tell us more about that?
Well, that's right. Tamer al-Kilani is a fighter and a militant of the Lion's Den, according, of course, to the Lion's Den, this newly formed Palestinian resistance group in Nablus. They said that Tamer was one of its, officials and fighters as well. And that's why they accused the Israeli regime for assassinating him. They issued a statement saying that they will not be silent to the killing and the assassination of Tamer al-Kilani, and that they would respond quickly to his killing. We have to mention that recently we have been speaking about Palestinians being resisting with the Israeli, resisting the Israeli soldiers, using their weapons, going to the Israeli military checkpoints, clashing with Israeli soldiers, and a number of Israeli soldiers had been either killed or wounded, and the Lions then had claimed responsibility for the recent attacks carried out against Israeli soldiers.
I want to thank you so much for coming on. That was Mona Kandil, our correspondent in Ramallah. Moving on, Russia says it's repelled an attack by the Ukrainian military to break through the border in the southern Kherson region, where it is evacuating civilians in anticipation of a counteroffensive.
In the Mykolaiv direction, the enemy attempt to breach the Russian troops' defenses by sending up to 2 battalion tactical groups on the west side of the Kherson region. All attacks were repulsed. The enemy was pushed back to their initial positions.
Konashenkov added Ukraine's offensive aimed at a number of settlements on the west side of the Dnipro River. Russia has been under pressure in Kherson as it braces for a Ukrainian push to retake the region. Authorities in Kherson have called on residents to immediately leave the city. The commander of Russian forces in Ukraine has described the military situation in those areas as tense and difficult. He says Ukrainian forces are deliberately targeting the infrastructure and residential buildings in Kherson. Since late August, Ukraine has recaptured hundreds of kilometers in its counterattacks. Kiev says Russian strikes on energy facilities have caused massive blackouts across Ukraine. The Ukrainian presidency says more than 1 million households are left without electricity. More than 670,000 of them are in the western region of Khmelnytsky alone. According to Ukraine's energy minister, Russian air attacks have hit at least half of Ukraine's thermal generation capacity since October 10th. As much as 40% of the country's energy infrastructure has been seriously damaged. The chief of Ukraine's national energy operator says some parts of the country are reducing their electricity use by up to 20%. Energy authorities believe the voluntary measures are not enough for the regions where the infrastructure has suffered the most damage. As the war in Ukraine continues to rage, our reporter Johnny Miller investigates allegations that the Ukrainian army is killing pro-Russian civilians in areas that it retakes.
A refugee camp somewhere in the Luhansk region of Donbass. The civilians here are Russian speakers who fled recent Ukrainian advances not far to the west.
Now, the people here won't speak to me on camera. They are simply too scared. I've also been told not to give the exact location of this site or even the town that we're in fear that the Ukrainians might target the center with artillery strikes.
This woman, sobbing into her hands, tells me she has family in Ukrainian territory. They also tell me that they are scared to be put on Telegram channels like this, called Collaborators of Luhansk. It posts the photos and details of anyone accused of working with the Russians. It includes teachers and nurses. Along the battle lines, pro-Ukrainians generally flee west, pro-Russians flee east. The ethnic boundaries of this once mixed country are being defined more clearly.
While this is a proxy war between Russia and NATO, it is also, at its root, a civil war between Ukrainian nationalists and its Russian-speaking minority, who are mainly situated in the east and the south of the country. The fact of the matter is, there is a strong likelihood, even a probability, that if Ukraine was to ever take back these four regions, there would be ethnic cleansing of the Russian-speaking population. The people here in Donbass say that this attempted ethnic cleansing by the Ukrainian army has been going on for the last 8 years.
While Russia and NATO continue to pursue their objectives on the battlefield, there is increasingly a peace to be made and new borders drawn if the views of the people living here were listened to. Johnny Miller, Donbass.
In Germany, tens of thousands of protesters have gathered to demand a more just distribution of government funds to deal with rising energy prices and living costs. The protests were held in six major cities, including the capital, Berlin. Protesters held signs bearing slogans calling for lowering inflation and more energy price subsidies for the poor. That after Parliament approved the government's 200 billion euro rescue package, which aims to protect companies and households from the impact of soaring energy prices. Some protesters are calling for a faster transition from fossil fuels and the switching off of nuclear power. German inflation in September hit its highest level in more than a quarter of a century at nearly 11%, driven up by higher energy costs. The United States looks set to have greater influence over the EU as the bloc's leaders seek to become less dependent on imports from Russia and China. Washington is stepping in to replace Moscow as the EU's major energy supplier, but the associated costs are enormous. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
EU leaders at a summit in Brussels agreed China is becoming too assertive. It's the same phrase they have been using for years with respect to Russia. Iran was also in their sights. New restrictive measures against Tehran were rubber stamped.
Sanctions have been taken against those who are participating in the repression of peaceful demonstrations. And this, of course, is linked to the support of Russia against Ukraine.
Analysts say the allegations against Iran are spurious and they are being vehemently contested. It's pointed out that the bloc sometimes ignores clear international law violations, even when there's zero ambiguity, for example, those perpetrated by Israel against Palestinians. The US is said to have even greater influence over the EU as the bloc moves to try and isolate Moscow and Beijing. It's suggested that has been Washington's plan all along. Sanctions against Russia over the war in Ukraine have driven energy costs to unmanageable levels. A complex package has been agreed in principle by EU leaders to try and lower prices and demand. Leaders admit the energy package is very complex and will take up to 3 weeks to try and finalise. Will this summit deliver positive results for EU citizens? It's a crucial question for millions of households and businesses, but also a vital political question for the bloc's leaders. Extreme left and extreme right anti-EU parties are waiting in the wings. Ignoring massive corruption findings by their own financial watchdog, EU leaders have agreed to provide 18 billion euro to the Ukrainian government in 2023. But that's nothing compared to what they will spend on lethal weapons for the country's army. Jerome Hughes, the EU Leaders Summit, Brussels.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com Mediaset.com/en. Supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely Thou art the All-Forgiving, the All-Compassionate.
In the limelight.
The Islamic Republic of Iran is taking long and rapid strides in the fields of science and technology. This is an undeniable fact and cannot be ignored even by Western journals, which rarely cover the achievements of Iran. Science Journal has recently published an article on Iran's world-class 3.4-meter optical telescope. Science describes the Iranian achievement in this way. In a major milestone for Iran's scientific community, astronomers have announced recently in Tehran that the Iranian National Observatory, INO, has seen first light. The world-class 3.4-meter optical telescope, whose future appeared cloudy just last year,
is operational and has acquired its debut images. Stay tuned to know more about this Iranian achievement. In a major milestone for Iran's scientific community, astronomers announced recently in Tehran that the Iranian National Observatory, INO, has seen first light. The world-class 3.4-meter optical telescope, whose future appeared cloudy just last year, is operational and has acquired its debut images. "We have been waiting for this moment for so long," says INO project director Habib Khosrow Shahi, an astronomer at the Institute for Research in Fundamental Sciences, IPM, in Tehran. First light for the $25 million observatory comes at a turbulent time, Khosrow Shahi acknowledges. INO's scientific odyssey began 2 decades ago and faced long odds. "When they started this project, it was just a dream. No one in Iran had attempted anything on this scale before," says Jerry Gilmore, an astronomer at the University of Cambridge and chair of INO's International Advisory Board. Last year, some former INO personnel voiced concerns about whether changes to INO's design might compromise its performance. "Those doubts have been put to rest," says optical engineer Lorenzo Zago, a consultant and advisory board member. INO opened its Dome for Sky calibration on September 27th and the next night imaged 282 ARP, a pair of galaxies some 319 million light-years from Earth. The image's resolution, 8/10 ARC seconds, and that of a second image taken a few days ago, 65/10 ARC seconds, are close to the limit set by atmospheric conditions at INO site, 3,600-meter Mount Gargash in central Iran. Gilmore says that resolution's spectacular, much better than expected. "The science run, which hopefully starts next summer, will show the quality of the design and construction," says Reza Mansouri, a theoretical astrophysicist at the Sharif University of Technology who led the project until 2016 and who last year expressed worries about the telescope's future. Engineers still need to complete tasks such as integrating software, fine-tuning the active optics, and installing the first science instrument, a high-quality imaging camera. Initial science goals include probing galaxy formation evolution and stellar evolution and hunting for exoplanets. The Iranian Observatory and two others in the region, a 4-meter infrared telescope in Turkey nearing completion, and a 3.4-meter optical telescope in India, fill a geographic gap in a global network that keys in on fleeting phenomena such as gamma ray bursts to try to pinpoint their locations and unravel their physics. Gilmore says you need a chain of telescopes all around the world to follow up. In building INO, astronomers in Iran had to surmount hurdles that few colleagues elsewhere face, sanctions that curtail high-tech imports, and visa restrictions limiting their travel abroad. The Iranian team purchased the glass mirror blanks from a German firm. INO engineers then had to figure out how to construct nearly everything else on their own. Zago says, What surprises me is that the know-how came so fast. They have been working like hell. At every stage, they increase the project's ambition and complexity, Gilmore says. For example, he says, when so-called active control systems, including sensors, actuators, and software that position a primary mirror, first became available for larger telescopes about a decade ago, INO engineers incorporated those into design. What's truly astonishing, Zago says, is a precision vacuum chamber that INO engineers and an Iranian company fashioned to coat the blanks with aluminum, transforming the polished glass into telescope mirrors. When the United Kingdom in 2000 set out to build an aluminizing system for its visible and infrared survey telescope for astronomy, Gilmore says, it took us forever to get right. Khosrow Shahi hopes to forge partnerships with international teams that might install state-of-the-art instrumentation in INO's four instrument slots. He says, the door is open for our side, though sanctions and politics could stymie some potential collaborations. In the meantime, Iran's burgeoning astronomy community, just a couple of dozen strong, at the project's outset, but several hundred scientists and students today, Khosrow Shahi says, is looking forward to some serious stargazing. We fought with disappointment, darkness, and also with words that could discourage us, says IPM's Maryam Turki, adding, but in the end, we witnessed this glorious birth.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Iran and the energy. The differences of opinion between two groups of scientists over the secretive Manhattan Project grew larger. This group of scientists, who were supposed to change the mid-20th century's fate, could not reach an agreement on a certain issue. Most of them were of the opinion that after making an atomic bomb, the United States should put its power on display at night for Japanese envoys in order to make the Japanese emperor surrender by threatening him with the bomb. However, theoretical physicist Edward Teller insisted on testing the atomic bomb on a city to learn about its effects on its population.
The American people in their right.
The only thing that could put an end to the differences was the speech by then U.S. President Franklin Roosevelt for the scientist. It tipped the balance in favor of Teller.
Among other things, and at the climax, he said, "You scientists are blamed for the weapons to be used. But I tell you that if you now won't work on weapons, the freedom of the world will be lost." Now, you know, I had the feeling that Roosevelt was talking to me. I was there when the letter was signed that awoke his interest in nuclear energy. I thought I knew he was talking about nuclear energy. Of the 2,000 scientists there, I felt he was talking to me.
Some people consider Edward Teller as a clear example of a mad scientist. Many critics believe that Stanley Kubrick was inspired by Edward Teller to create the notorious character Dr. Strangelove.
The report, my conclusion, was that this idea was not a practical deterrent for reasons which at this moment must be all too obvious.
Then you mean it is possible for them to have built such a thing?
Mr. President, the technology required is easily within the means of even the smallest nuclear power. It requires only the will to do so.
After the TNT explosion test, it was eventually decided that the first bomb should go off in Alamogordo, which is located 230 miles south of New Mexico in Los Alamos. The operation was codenamed Trinity. The codename comes from the belief in the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit in Christianity. They were planning to launch the largest massacre of human beings in the name of Jesus. This 21-ton bomb was 200 times stronger than the calibration test. The light was so intense that could immediately cause blindness. It was visible within the radius of 16 kilometers. It melted the sands in the desert and turned them into green crystals. The radioactive effects remained in the region for 50 years. Before the bomb was tested, two other bombs named Little Boy and Fat Man were secretly taken to Oceania to be prepared for an attack on two Japanese cities. It was 8:15 a.m. local time on August 6, 1945. The first bomb, Little Boy, was dropped on Hiroshima by a bomber named Enola Gay. For the bomber to have enough time to flee the explosion, they dropped the bomb via a parachute. To make the detonation stronger, the bomb was set to go off 576 meters above the ground. Those who saw Little Boy explode mid-air from a distance said they saw a new sun in the sky. After the blast, two-thirds of the buildings in Hiroshima, including steelmaking and industrial factories, were completely destroyed. The only thing that was left standing in the city was the Hiroshima Prefectural Industrial Promotion Hall. The explosion happened on top of the building's dome, and as it was within the central focus of the blast, it was not completely devastated. The moment the bomb went off, about 100,000 residents in Hiroshima died on the spot. While Japan was in shock and the Japanese people had almost realized that they were defeated, then U.S. President Harry Truman announced that this bomb was just a warning. 3 days later, another bomb was detonated in Nagasaki, which claimed the lives of 40,000 people in that city. Next day, Japan conceded defeat and surrendered to U.S. conditions to end the war. In the following years, more people succumbed to injuries sustained after the explosion due to radiation. Even though the U.S. honored its forces who were involved in the Manhattan Project and the agents in the carnage were awarded, the events pushed the public to rise up against nuclear weapons. The harms caused by the newly invented elements were not always sudden and tangible like atomic bombs. The start of nuclear war dated back to 50 years before when radioactive material was first discovered. In the spring of 1896, Marie Curie and her husband, Pierre Curie, discovered the amazing characteristics of some mineral stones, including uranium. They realized that the elements in the stones emit radiations that are not visible but pass through many barriers. The radiation was named gamma. After her husband's death, Marie Curie continued her research in 1910. It led to the discovery of radium as a new radioactive element.
Madame Curie.
The discovery made her the first woman to receive the Nobel Prize twice. The award cost Marie Curie a lot. Many doctors say she was a victim of radioactive material, especially radium, during her experiments in the lab. The possibility was raised in the following years because back then nuclear scientists did not know anything about the harmful effects of nuclear material. It caused bigger catastrophe. The discovery of radium among natural radioactive elements with the half-life of about 1,600 years left everyone in astonishment. The element's strange radiation added new color to advertisement in the West. Since the damage caused by the element and its radiation hadn't come to light yet, opportunistic traders sought to fulfill people's demands with these elements. They claim that this dangerous material can help him live longer and healthier, so they introduced it to people's daily lives. They were used in the most sensitive cosmetic and hygienic products, including body lotions, lipsticks, toothpaste, and even water, bread, and chocolate. They claim that radium as an ingredient in products is considered something positive. On the other hand, in 1917, the United States had just been involved in World War I. The army needed clocks whose hands were luminous at night in the dark. So factories across the U.S. took up the job and started producing clocks. To paint the tiny impact numbers on the clock's screen, they instructed female workers to press the tip of the brush with their lips in order to keep it tiny. They were told that working with radium paint was not hazardous. After a while, some of the workers were diagnosed with strange diseases. They would go to the dentist to pull their decayed teeth, but not only wouldn't they be cured, their teeth would get injured. Things gradually got worse. After dentists touched their jaws, they would get injured. Many of them had cancerous tumors in their bones and they would easily break. The first person who died was a 25-year-old woman named Amelia Maggia, nicknamed Molly. She succumbed to the disease in less than a year. the doctors didn't have an answer to her mysterious death. Gradually, as more and more female workers came down with illness, they pieced together the puzzle and found out that radium was the reason behind the deadly disease. Although, after 5 or 6 years in the mid-30s, advertising products that contained radioactive element and using them in products were altogether banned, their effects continued to last. After the atomic bombing in the World War, the radium girls and similar incidents like the Chernobyl disaster in Ukraine in 1986 and the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear disaster in 2011 after the 8.9 strong earthquake, the international community rose up against nuclear energy. But the question is, why do countries, even Japan that was subject to the biggest atomic curse, not give up nuclear energy? Why does a country like Iran make so much effort and spend so much money to achieve such an apparently dangerous energy? West Asia is known for its wars. The wars were initially waged under different excuses, but they usually pursue the same goal, and that is oil. The United States' latest direct war in the region was launched in 2003. The U.S. invaded Iraq under the pretext that the country possessed weapons of mass destruction, like biological and nuclear bombs. But after years of war and bloodshed, no weapons that were used as a pretext to invade the country were found. Even though no unconventional weapons were found in the country, it was rich in oil resources that was hugely extracted. After the invasion, oil was extracted and used to push U.S. policies and economy forward. The U.S. dealt with Iraq and raised accusations that are somehow similar to Israel's behavior vis-a-vis Iran.
This is a few. That Iran has another secret facility in Tehran, a secret atomic warehouse for storing massive amounts of equipment and material from Iran's secret nuclear weapons program. We exposed the site of Iran's secret atomic archive. It's right here, in the Shorabad district of Tehran. Today, I'm revealing the site of a second facility, Iran's secret atomic warehouse. It's right here, in the Turkuzabad district of Tehran, just 3 miles away.
The Turkuzabad carpet washing center was Netanyahu's last trick for the media to get the international community on board his Iranophobia scheme for, quote, possessing nuclear weapons. But the Israeli regime did not stop there at the media campaign level. To date, it has assassinated top Iranian nuclear scientists. He's someone who doesn't want to realize that based on numerous inspections by the International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, and the religious views of the Iranian leader, it is not after nuclear weapons.
As of today, I can state that Iran is implementing its nuclear-related commitments. We have had access to all the sites and locations which we needed to visit.
So why does Israel keep insisting on the accusation and pursue such confrontational policies with Iran to stop the country from reaching nuclear technology? Is it possible that the objections are just excuses? Just like what happened in Iraq? How can the energy benefit Iran that the Israeli regime does everything it can to stop it from reaching the technology? It was exactly 6 years after the first and last nuclear bomb blast that a national lab in Idaho was lit up by only four 200-watt light bulbs. Even though the EBR-1 project's goal was not to generate electricity, it corroborated theories concerning producing electricity from nuclear energy. The system, which was more complicated than making an atomic bomb, was later named nuclear reactor. The reactors could easily provide electricity for a city or more without constructing huge dams or consuming thousands of tons of charcoal and emitting pollutant gases. 70 years after the four famous light bulbs in Idaho were lit up, a little further away, Bill Gates, as the richest man on the planet and the owner of Microsoft, was investing on nuclear reactors that could work for 60 years after fueling just once. Today, reactors have considerably reduced consumption of oil condensates for producing energy. For example, the 1,000-megawatt reactor in Iran's Bushehr has saved 47 million barrels of oil that would otherwise be used for generating electricity in 7 years. In Europe, generating electricity is the foremost goal of using nuclear energy for peaceful purposes, but in Asia, there is a more burning issue, and that is water. West Asia is among the driest regions in the continent. It has only 1% of fresh water resources in the world. Many analysts believe that the next wars in the region will not be over oil. They say water is a serious concern in this part of the world. In this dry region, Israel has managed to export its agricultural products to all across the world, besides meeting 95% of its population's demands. The Israeli regime does not have underground water resources or many rivers. However, it has tipped environmental balance in its own favor by using nuclear technology to rein in nature. On the shores of the Red Sea, the saline water is desalinated for agriculture and drinking. As an example, Sorek, as the largest water treatment plant in the world, located 15 kilometers south of Tel Aviv, can purify 230 million cubic meters of water and tackle water shortage to a great extent. This amount of water is equal to the water Iran annually receives from the Karajan-Latian dams for drinking and agriculture in Tehran and Elbourz provinces, with a population of about 15 million people. Even though only 20% of the land occupied by the Israeli regime is arable, today it has become an agricultural hub.
Is the finished product, desalinated water. And according to the officials here at the plant, it's a more complete water than water that hasn't had the saline removed, because in the process of desalination, minerals are added back.
It seems the Israeli regime and Washington are seeking to stop Iran from accessing nuclear energy, not because they are worried it might make a nuclear bomb, but they are concerned that Iran might achieve the nuclear technology that can strengthen its independence and tackle millions of Iranians' needs. Water and energy are among the most vital necessities in agriculture and other industries, and even if a country like Iran does not need nuclear energy to fulfill its needs, it still cannot forego the energy. If the fruit produced by farmers goes bad before reaching the market, it will bring nothing but financial loss and physical exhaustion. Many kinds of fruit cannot resist against natural bacteria and fungus, as they quickly go bad. Today, the key to reach the market, especially the international one, is in the hand of irradiation. Thanks to nuclear technology, radiation technology has been around for 60 years and is used in the agriculture industry. Exposing fruits to the light emission of radiation for a short time can destroy the larvae and bacteria in fruits and increase its shelf life. Today, many agricultural products and even fruits like strawberry that have very short shelf life are exported to other countries. Exposing fruits to the gamma ray at entry points and quarantine centers of a country can stop the spread of insects and pests.
We have to look at the taste, the color, the granulometry, is there some foreign material, and also we look at the microbiology. Spices can be contaminated up to 1 million bacteria per gram. And with the irradiation, it can reduce by 99.9%. Other treatment will not offer that kind of reduction. Irradiation for us will not change the taste, the color, will not leave any residue, and also is really lowering the microbiological count.
When we piece together different problems like medical treatment, industrial experiments, and other issues a country can resolve by using the nuclear technology, we find out that there is a good reason behind Iran's political and economic battle to achieve the technology. Today, if a country wants to guarantee its economic, scientific, and technological future, it needs to step in this field.
In the limelight.
Former U.S. Vice President Mike Pence's aides told the committee investigating the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol that former President Donald Trump pressured his vice president to reverse his defeat in the 2020 election. According to the panel's report, Trump pressured and even threatened Mike Pence despite being repeatedly told that it was illegal to do so. Trump has repeatedly denied the accusations against him and has continued to repeat his claims of widespread fraud in the U.S. elections. Former U.S. President and his supporters, including many Republican members of Congress, described the January 6th committee as a political plot. We take a look at this issue and some of the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The website of the British newspaper The Daily Mail has written, "A new book reveals former President Donald Trump repeatedly assured aides after he lost the 2020 presidential election that he would remain in the White House and not cede power to Joe Biden." According to a forthcoming book by New York Times reporter Maggie Haberman, Trump told one aide, "I'm just not going to leave the White House." Maggie Haberman wrote, "Trump seemed to realize he had lost to Biden immediately after the election, but his mood later changed. He told another aide, 'We're never leaving. How can you leave when you won an election?'" The book, Confidence Man, The Making of Donald Trump and the Breaking of America, is being released on 4th of October. The new revelation sheds more light on the chaotic aftermath of the 2020 election, which was marked by Donald Trump's refusal to cede power to Joe Biden and his efforts to overturn the election results. Trump began expressing his intention not to leave the White House in January of 2021 as incoming President Joe Biden was getting ready to take over. During a conversation with Republican National Committee Chairwoman Ronna McDaniel, Trump asked, "Why should I leave if they stole it from me?" In line with his efforts to overturn the election, Trump had called on his supporters to march on the Capitol and disrupt the certification of Joe Biden's electoral victory, which led to the 6th of January 2021 riot and attack on the U.S. Capitol. Maggie Haberman writes in her book, "Trump's pledge that he would not depart the White House had no historical precedent, and his declaration left advisers wondering what he might do next. The former president, however, did not make his intentions public. When asked by a reporter at the time whether he would be willing to leave the White House if Biden had won the electoral vote, Trump responded by saying, "Certainly I will, and you know that I will." However, he was still insisting that the election had been stolen from him through massive electoral fraud. The New York Times covers the same story but from a different angle. The U.S. Justice Department has issued about 40 subpoenas over the past week, seeking information about efforts by Donald Trump and his allies to overturn the 2020 election. Citing people familiar with the situation, the New York Times said Boris Epstein, a longtime Trump advisor, and Mike Roman, a campaign strategist for Donald Trump, had their cell phones seized recently as evidence. According to the New York Times, Dan Scavino, Donald Trump's former social media director, was also among those who were subpoenaed, which said the group included low-level aides as well as senior advisors. An attorney for Dan Scavino did not immediately respond to a request for comment from the Reuters news agency, while Reuters was unable to contact Roman and Boris Epstein. The subpoenas seeking